If someone from the public who knows very little about AI, AI safety, risks, benefits, things that could go well, they had to know one important thing.
It's like, you know, just look at it how it is today, instead try and look at the last like 3 or 4 years of like where we've come in that time and imagine like another 3 or 4 years of progress. You know, there are arguments about whether 3 or 4 years of progress will happen, but it's a debate. It's not like clear cut that it's going to slow down. When I am talking about AI policy, I would really love it for everyone to have in mind that things could change quite dramatically, quite quickly, and usually much quicker than policy windows last for.
So I'm joined today by Jamie Bernardi, who was one of the co-founders of Blue Dot Impact. Blue Dot are an organization that run courses on important areas such as AI alignment, AI governance, and biosecurity. But having now moved on from Blue Dot, Jamie is currently working on AI governance research, and he's doing a research fellowship at the Institute for AI Policy and Strategy. Jamie, thank you so much for speaking today.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot for inviting me to speak.
So yeah, before we talk about some of your kind of current work in the governance research area, it'd be good to start with what I think you're kind of perhaps most well known for, which is being one of these co-founders of Blue Dot Impact. So yeah, first of all, what is Blue Dot Impact? And can you tell us a story of like how you set it up with some of your co-founders?
So Blue Dot Impact is first and foremost an education charity. We run courses, run courses online primarily with 300-400 people at a time, meeting up week by week to read and discuss course material that will help them learn about the important areas you mentioned. So AI safety, biosecurity. I think they're the main ones to this day. How did it start? So I guess going all the way back to Cambridge in 2022, where I was based at the time, I'd just finished working as a machine learning engineer and had started a short research stint in technical machine learning research, which I never finished because I ended up meeting my co-founder and the director of Blue Dot Impact, Dewi Owam, who had run, a pilot of a course on AI alignment and then had run like a larger version over the summer during the pandemic. So it's kind of almost, I don't know what Dewi would say, but it feels like almost an accident that it scaled up so well online because we started in Cambridge and we have to run this online now, let's open it up. And it turned out there was a lot of interest in AI safety at that time that wasn't being served through anything else. And I guess the picture is very different now. There's a lot more interest and more venues to serve it. So this had run and he approached me. I'd been running like a small reading group with technical people in Cambridge at that time. And asked me to run the next one. And yeah, I guess the rest is history. I ran the next one and interest continued to grow. We continued to think of ways to change the course and scale it. And we did for another 2 years and founded the org, Blue Dot Impact, I think August 2022. So it's been around for 2 years with its current name, but the idea has been around for a few years now. And yeah, things seem to be going really well.
Yeah, and you've got courses on like a couple of different areas, like I mentioned, AI safety and AI governance and biosecurity. If someone, you know, watching this isn't at all familiar with these kind of ideas and areas, like how would you explain, what each of these courses is focusing on and the kind of issues it's trying to bring to the mind of the person participating?
Yeah. One of the kind of founding ideas we had was, I guess, as we've said a couple of times, to focus on important areas, but particularly areas that weren't being served super well by like existing academic institutions like universities. It started with the AI alignment course, which I guess is a subset of AI safety, which is particularly around like how do we get AI systems to do what we want or what we meant by what we wanted, and what we told them we wanted. There were very few academic courses on this, but lots of people interested in it. Primarily because it had been kind of an area that this movement of effective altruism had focused on, and like lots of people who'd followed that thought, we really want to work on AI safety and AI alignment in particular. And so there was like a large group of people that wanted to learn about this through that. So that's the kind of chronology of it. It started with that course. Dewi worked at that time with Richard Noh, who was, I think at that time finishing at DeepMind, but anyway, now he works on AI policy at OpenAI to kind of figure out what this is, what the primary texts are, and bring that together. Anyway, your question was about what are the areas, so that's that one. And then I guess the next piece of chronology is, not only is technical side important, so we're serving mostly machine learning engineers and things with that course, but it might be important for governments to get a handle on AI safety and figure out how to govern this technology. It sounds obvious now, but in 2021, when we were starting to think about these things, governments were not very interested in AI safety. I think the Office for AI in the UK had 6 or 7 people in it, and now it's almost 100 working in the same sorts of areas, maybe more. Similar process of trying to figure out what this field even was, and then condense it into 8 weeks of material and teach that. So AI governance, I guess, consists of a few things. If I was to point at broad areas, one is like figuring out what the levers for governance are, which is like what actions can governments even take to change how the technology is developed. So one big area is become compute governance, because this is like a physical entity which you can manage, and the US has decided to put in place export controls against China, for example. Not necessarily saying that's like an AI safety policy, but that's like an example of how you can use the lever of compute to change how the technology is developed. And other ones are things like setting standards about safety techniques you might want to employ in labs, and like how standard setting happens. This is all stuff people need to learn about, so that's what we were teaching there. And then all the way on the other side of the fence, so biosecurity is the other main area we chose to work on. At one point we thought we might do more courses, but it turned out like these courses have been quite successful and like continue to be pressing and underserved, so they've really consolidated on those. But to explain what biosecurity is, essentially, yeah, having us all haven't been through the COVID pandemic, the thesis is like, how do we make this less likely, especially as the threat of pandemics increases over time? Both like natural pandemics seem to be becoming more likely. This isn't my wheelhouse, but it seems to be becoming more likely because of things like farming makes it more likely that viruses jump over to humans. But also the other part is around like human engineered viruses, which could be coming. In fact, yeah, humans can engineer viruses today, but this could increase like present an increasing biosecurity threat, as well as like lab accidents where humans are playing around with viruses that are now extinct or not very common, and they could jump out. So that's another aspect of biosecurity, essentially, like both how do we manage pandemics if they begin, and like how do we prevent accidents like that happening? And that's also areas people need to learn about to work on it.
Okay, yeah. And so you told us about these three kind of areas you look at, but with so many different issues, you know, in the world and problems, like how did you come to decide that these would be the things that are important to focus on? Perhaps you can connect this as well to, I guess, some of the inspiration maybe for Blue Dot, which is an interest in the kind of effect of altruism, and maybe these are some of the ideas that they kind of say are important things to tackle. But yeah, how did you come up with AI and bio being key things for people to learn about?
Yeah, certainly no accident that it tracks with the sorts of areas that effective altruists have been interested in. I guess there's two reasons for that. One, it's like it certainly influenced some of my thinking early on. I can talk about that. And the other is, it, as I mentioned briefly in my previous answer, it had created these like large groups of people that really wanted to like work on particular issues, but there was very little out there to serve them. Like the infrastructure hadn't followed. So that kind of creates an opportunity to like direct this energy into important challenges. So I guess speaking briefly about my own interest, I like went to university in 2015, and almost 10 years ago now, and wanted to solve climate change, work on nuclear fusion, be a physics researcher and whatnot. But yeah, so I guess like doing good was always a kind of important part of what I wanted to do with my education. And then, yeah, at university, met people who were involved with effective altruism and sort of put to me the challenge of like trying to do the most good. And to me, it's a very logical person that made a lot of sense. So, yeah, around that time, like started speaking about AI and like noticing these problems with the like early version of the technology back in 2015 that there wasn't like a clear way to solve them. And I think many of those have come to fruition around like, yes, being able to like tell an AI system exactly what you wanted in the OpenAI 01 system card. Sorry, small aside. They did a test where they asked an AI agent to like solve a cybersecurity challenge. It couldn't get into the environment, so it like hacked itself in. That isn't something we told it to do, but in order to like solve the goal it was given, it did this. So like, this is a problem we thought was a problem of 2015, continues to be a problem. So I think, you know, that certainly the community was right about some things there. And this, yeah, definitely like fostered my interest in AI safety initially. And then I suppose, yeah, the other aspect is, yeah, I'm not sure there's much more to say about it. There's like hundreds of people had also gone through the path I'd gone through, like got interested in effective altruism, been talked to about AI safety, thought maybe they were technical people that suited them to like work on this challenge. Like, okay, where do I go? And I think at the time there was like one or two PhD programs where you could do this. I think one course which ran every 2 years in Berkeley, teaching people what alignment was, and how to like make progress on it. So the very underserved area. So yeah, these two things come together, something we knew about, something that lots of people wanted to work on, like made it a very good initial area for a course. Biosecurity, I guess, again, not a field that I'd tracked closely myself, but very similar story. It's the sort of problem that could cause a lot of havoc in the world. If left unaddressed, I guess with COVID it did, but could have been worse too, with like a higher death rate, even though the death rate was quite high. And yeah, I guess again, COVID proves that this sort of thing is the sort of thing to get a handle on. And if there had been like stockpiles of PPE in countries like the UK, there would have been less of a scramble. There would have been more to go around at hospitals. The mRNA vaccine was developed very quickly, which I guess is like another key biosecurity outcome, but it took months to roll it out, which probably led to lots of people losing their life, where a faster rollout wouldn't have. Of course, there are like counterfactuals. If you'd rolled it out too fast and there'd been some problem with it, this would have been bad too, but like shortening those cycles would be a really key, like massive global improvement in the world. So yeah, I think these are two areas where like a bit more work. They're underserved by like public budgets and whatnot, and certainly by the for-profit sector, it's not naturally incentivized. And with a bit more work, we could do like a lot of good. And these are just two we landed on. I'm sure there are like other challenges which could lead to a similar output for the same inputs.
So you said, yeah, you initially kind of more concerned with climate change, now shifted towards, you know, AI would be something I guess you'd kind of rank higher in terms of how much you worry about it. Just intrigued, like, yeah, how you'd maybe compare the risks of AI and bio to what you were, you know, initially worried about climate change.
Well, ranking is a dangerous thing to do. I wouldn't necessarily say I'm like less worried about climate change, but became more worried about AI. I think also at that time, I'm not sure if I'd make the same calculation now, but I'm sort of invested in this field. So that plays a huge part in my calculation. It's like I've spent 9 years reading about, learning about AI. If I tried to do that with climate now, it would be like another few years at least until I was like up to speed to be able to have like hopefully as much impact as I can on this field, which I know about and have network in. So yeah, at the time, one idea going into it was like thinking about AI safety was a bit weird. People still might think it is a bit weird, but because it was a bit weird, there were even fewer people doing it. And I think there's testament to that in that by like spending a few years thinking about it, when very few people were thinking about it, meant that I could co-found what I think has been like a very impactful organization in this space. Means like, luckily in this case, the bet paid off, I would say, for my career and hopefully for the world. And there might be like other areas which were weird to go into in 2015, which people tried to break into, which didn't pan out to be huge problems. So yeah, I would frame it more as like a bet that this was being underserved and like without downrating climate change, just like uprating this and also using this reasoning to be like, let's try and invest in this field.
You said a second ago that ranking things is dangerous. What did you mean by that exactly?
Yeah. I mean, maybe, yeah, we're starting to get into like why effective altruism isn't so popular today. This idea of trying to put numbers to everything is one that's initially attractive and I think like does lead to like broad changes in intuition around what we should if we're, you know, our goal is to like do the most good, as I mentioned before, what we should spend our time on to achieve that. It can only go so far, I suppose, is the crux of what I'm saying around the danger of ranking things. Like, I think once you've identified a few priority areas, like I mentioned, climate change, AI safety, biosecurity, I think others would fall into that for me, like global poverty and factory farming is something I care about too, trying to reduce, to be clear. These are kind of like huge issues that are huge in scale. I think you can make real progress on them by like dedicating time, money to them. Once you've kind of got to that point, I think there's little left to do in terms of like ranking them to make intelligent decisions. I guess those five areas are quite different and require different skill sets and expertise. It all depends where you are in your career. For me, like, I don't need to rank AI safety and other things necessarily because I'm in this field. I think it's important enough that I'll stay here for now. If you're trying to choose a degree and you really like biology as much as you like computer science, as much as you like, well, I'm not so sure about what the skills are needed for the other fields, but then maybe you'd want to like think about this ranking. But I think often we kind of know a bit more what we want to work on based on our kind of what work we enjoy doing, what perception of ourselves we have, which, yeah, I guess is something I've been learning as an adult too. So yeah, I think for the person, like you kind of know what you're wanting to do. I guess more globally, like ranking is not necessarily dangerous, but can tie you up in arguments which you don't want to be having. Like, that's why I bristled at your question of like, do you think AI safety is more important than climate change? Is like, well, not really. I'm not going to like venture to say that. Most people don't. In fact, it's only effective altruists that tie themselves up in these arguments around like which is more important. Most people are willing to say like both are important. I think I'm willing to say both are important. We should dedicate resources to both.
And towards the end of your time at Blue Dot, you were seconded, I believe, by the UK government department, DCIT, Department for Science, Innovation and Technology, to kind of help them identify and scout talent for the UK's new AC, so AI Safety Institute. What is the AI Safety Institute and what were you doing there exactly, trying to kind of get people on the team?
I think also around a year ago now, the UK government turned its frontier model task force into an AI Safety Institute, or at least that's my interpretation of what the series of events. What is it? I guess it's an attempt and a successful attempt to bring in technical talent into the government. I think, I mean, I'm not familiar with every area of the government, but it seems to be fairly unprecedented and an unprecedented success in like bringing in like bleeding edge kind of industry talent or industry level talent. Not all of it, all of them are from industry, many from academia and whatnot, to be like directly hired by the civil service. More often you'd be like consulting or in a company that's contracted. These people have like chosen to go and work in the government, which is really great. And what they're doing, I think the mission of the AI Safety Institute, which does kind of describe what they're doing, is like minimize surprise to the UK and international governments on like advances in AI or something like that. And main thing they started doing is model evaluations. So just measuring the capabilities of models, like how good are they at hacking like computer systems, how good are they uplifting people in biosecurity, doing bio attacks, if that's something they wanted to do. The answer for that is like not much yet, just to be clear, but it's worth checking. And other capabilities like that, like deception and persuasiveness as well. Increasingly, it's building its teams to measure like downstream societal impacts too, which I think is really important. It's like akin to some of the work I've been doing this year. Which, yeah, I think it's like the other piece of the puzzle. Like you measure the kind of upstream capabilities, make some predictions about what might happen, release your model, and like be on top of measuring what impact that's having on the world. And I think that's like a really good institute to exist. So was fully behind UK government setting that up. And yeah, what I was doing there, as I mentioned, like I was very much in the space of finding early talent who wanted to work on AI safety, so machine learning engineers at companies like Google, Meta, etc., who wanted to use their skills for good, was like a big target audience. Again, PhDs, like what to do next, another target audience, and students as well. But as this org was scaling up and like wanting to hire people, I think they have like 30 or 50 technical people now, which is enough to justify a recruiter. Yeah, they asked me to come in to help them find those people, like reach out to them. In the end, what I ended up doing was help with its sort of recruitment marketing strategy, like making sure that technical people understood what the AI Safety Institute was. I'd been following this along closely, so I was like really excited and hyped by it, but a lot of the people I was speaking to were like, government, what's this? And I mean, yeah, myself included, when I was a more technical person, you tend not to track what the government's doing. So just making sure we were communicating that message to technical people was, yeah, what I decided to spend my time doing.
And so what were you looking for in technical people? Maybe both their skills and, yeah, are there any interesting kind of like aspects of someone's personality or kind of traits, like what they're like that you kind of want? Like what would someone be like who would thrive in this kind of team and environment?
So I guess the AI Safety Institute describes itself as a startup within government, which I think is true from what I've seen. They really are moving fast on quite a few areas, but also like communicates well to technical people. This is a place they're going to enjoy. They're going to be around people that like to move like they do. It's kind of codes tech culture. So I think in some ways that already attracts the right sort of person. I guess another area is like the people that tend to apply tend to be very motivated by doing public service because of the salaries and the sorts of people that are working at the AI Safety Institute. That sort of bar for like experience in machine learning and things like this is really quite high because lots of people want to help out on this challenge. But yeah, because of like how talented they are, they could earn lots and lots in industry, for better or for worse. But the government can only pay so much because of civil service rules. I think they have done some work around so that it's higher than like the base rate civil service salary, which was, as I understand, like hard to do. But they did it, and I think that, you know, mitigates some of the loss you would get. But yeah, everyone who works there really wants the institute to do well and like is really driven by the mission as a result. So yeah, I guess those are like the personality aspects, not necessarily like selected for that, but I think as a place it attracts those sorts of people. Yeah, on the technical side, I think it's what you said. I'm hard to describe. I guess it would be the sort of person that for many of the research leads, like has published at least archive papers, preprints. That's like kind of a bar for many computer science roles, like PhDs these days. And then otherwise just like strong engineering talent, maybe that have worked in software companies, so have that experience about how to like support experiments and things like that. There are probably a ton of other roles. It's been almost a year since I've been there, so who knows what they're looking for now. All the roles are on the internet, on the website.
Okay, great. And so let's move on to now to kind of what you're doing. So you're now in the AI governance research kind of field and area. I mean, you touched on it a bit earlier, but let's kind of go back again. So firstly, yeah, what is AI governance? What exactly are the kind of key issues and problems the field is trying to kind of solve?
So I guess many of the same risks, although when it comes to governance, I think the tools you have are both, I think, like more effective, but blunter. So I think you end up addressing like quite a broad range of the risks, which I can break down in a minute, with the same sorts of interventions. What are the risks people are worried about? I think, you know, there are multiple ways of breaking it down, but there's still at least kind of two main areas. One is the kind of incremental change that deploying AI has on society, and I've mentioned some of them. I mean, there's some overlap too. So some incremental changes might be kind of, we're on the internet, we're on Twitter, we're interacting with people. It's harder to know if some of those are completely like powered by ChatGPT. There's always been kind of influence operations on social media. from foreign states or whoever else. But now there's this risk of it being amplified through AI systems which can pass as like humans on social media. Similar worries are kind of like there's going to be a lot more AI generated content. Starting to see this. There's been like a healthy immune response, I think, from people. They just don't want this. And kind of, I think we might pull through just on people preferring real content. But anyway, that's one of the risks, is like the information environment. I think there are other risks, like generative AI really helps with automating lots of processes in companies. This means there's probably less human oversight, and this could lead to mistakes being made by AI systems. There's things like automation bias, where like if a human's told what to do by a computer, they're less likely to question it than if they were told by another person, for example. I think that's the right formulation, but anyway, more likely to accept a computer output than they would their own intuition, at least. And these, you know, we know that AI systems are biased, and ChatGPT is no exception. As these make more decisions, this can like cause incremental but like pretty damaging change to society. Then a way this has been put by someone I worked with in Oxford, Atusa, has kind of broken it into these like accruing and incremental risks, and then like more acute risks, which again, there's some overlap. So I would mention like cybersecurity being a more acute risk when you get to the point of like AI agents being particularly strong at like cyber hacking. They could just go off and like find vulnerabilities on the internet and potentially automatically exploit them for whatever means, be it stealing data sometimes. I think stealing data is probably the main one. The sort of demonstration showing this is starting to begin. I like hesitated for a moment to call that an acute risk, because it is also an incremental risk. Like hackers are using this a bit to uplift their operations now, in the same way software engineers do. They sit with an LLM and like ask it how to do things, and this accelerates them. I'm not sure if there'll be some point where we'll call this acute, or whether this will just like incrementally increase for some time. Other like conjectures, I guess, people are making, or hypotheses people have around like, will AI be enough to uplift bioterrorists as well, who like at the moment aren't skilled or knowledgeable enough to carry out bio attacks? There's been some, I think there are like lots of other areas to that which weren't initially appreciated, but we're starting to get into the details of like how AI might uplift things there. So that's a long overview of the risks. But yeah, you were also asking about how governance tries to solve them.
Yeah, I guess. Oh yeah, I suppose you've talked about the main things that they're worried about. So yeah, what are some kind of way their techniques? What are they kind of trying to do practically actually to stop some of these things happening?
Yeah, I think there'll be no like one answer to this. I think that's partly by design. I guess there are these ideas like the Swiss cheese model or defense in depth, where you like put in place multiple layers of a defense or risk mitigations which don't work themselves in entirety, but together hopefully makes like it quite hard to. The reason it's Swiss cheese is like you might get through one hole in the defense, but then on the next layer you hit a slab of cheese and it stops you. No one solution is perfect, but there are a few approaches. Evaluations is, I guess, part of a bigger theme of like creating visibility. I think like as the public and governments and even technicians appreciate the risks more, people will just make better decisions, I think, around like how they choose to deploy systems, what they expect from tech companies, and whether people are like willing to use those businesses depends on whether they trust the outputs. And the more you increase the visibility of the risks and flaws, the more pressure that puts on companies to address them. So that's one like quite relatively cheap thing you can do. You don't need laws or anything. You can just present what's going on, and that does require capacity like AI safety institutes. Then I guess that could feed into more stringent models, like deciding whether to let a model onto the market or not, or even having the ability to like pull a model off the market. I think that would apply in cases I mentioned, like if we found that this system was really good at doing cyber attacks and we hadn't like had time to improve our cyber defenses, then you might say, well, we have to take this off the market. That's like an idea. I don't think any government is particularly close to this. The EU has the most stringent AI policy, but isn't anywhere near threatening to take a model off the market today. There's kind of two main areas. I guess I've mentioned this kind of the geopolitics of AI as well. So the US has identified AI as like a strategic technology, either militarily or economically, both, I suppose, and has like put restrictions on China about what computer chips they can have. So that's one way of governing AI. And they're hoping, yeah, as I understand it, they're hoping to like slow down China's AI progress, maintain US lead in military and economic domains for reasons of like national security and I guess values that they uphold that they feel China doesn't. So yeah, there's that aspect to it too, not one I work on as much. Yeah, I'm sure I'm neglecting many, but ultimately it comes down to trying to manage each part of the AI process, from like the ingredients that go into it with data and compute, to how they're trained, like what techniques you're using to make sure they're safe. And there are these ideas like safety cases, like labs have to write down what their plan is for making sure our system is safe before they deploy it. And that's like the pre-training time. And then whilst you're training, there might be like certain techniques you should employ to make sure you're not, that where things start to get a bit detailed is like, make sure you're not training a system that's like horribly misaligned. And then like once you have a system, how you choose to deploy it is also an area of governance. So there are choices like putting it behind an API, open sourcing it. An area I'm currently working on is like giving it to defenders first, potentially before public release, to solve this problem of like not having enough time for cyber defense, for example. So there's like the whole stack of AI is under the purview of AI governance, I would say.
And you're currently doing a research fellowship at the Institute for AI Policy and Strategy. Yeah, who are this organization and what are you up to there exactly?
IOPS is, I think, describe themselves as a think tank, and primarily based focused on US policy. I suppose my read is because this is because most of the frontier AI labs are there, and they mostly focus on kind of risks surrounding frontier AI models, which basically pertains to LLMs and whatever the most kind of advanced model is at the moment. They focus on a few things. They focus on compute governance, as I mentioned. It's particularly hot topic in the US. Also just broadly standards and policy around AI, which is a broad area, and around like all the things I mentioned before. There's another team I'm failing to remember, but you can find it on their website. What have I been doing there? So they offer these 3-month research placements to bring in people like myself and around 10 other people. It's nice to go out to DC to figure out how they do AI policy there for a couple of weeks, and then for the remaining 10 weeks was back here in London. Despite the US focus, I think for me it makes much more sense to stay in the UK space, because you know, this is a place I'm familiar with. I'm familiar with the people involved in AI policy in the UK. So there's some flexibility there, which is great. I suppose concretely what I've been working on with them is kind of building on something I'd worked on previously, which is this idea of societal adaptation to advanced AI, where I think, the short version of that is there are actions we can take downstream of an AI system being deployed that will make the world safer. I've mentioned cybersecurity a bit before. That's because this is an area I'm currently working on. The idea is, if we're worried that AI systems can do cyber attacks, then one way to mitigate that would be to make sure there are no cyber vulnerabilities for AI systems to exploit, as well as, and other people might focus more on trying to block requests to do cyber attacks in AI models. So I'm trying to chart this other path, like how do we need to change the world to adapt to the prevalence of this system. I've been researching this idea of like, are there ways we could give an AI system to cybersecurity companies, presuming that this will actually boost their cyber defense, which I think maybe now it's more questionable, but in 5 years, if we assume that AI is going to keep improving at the rate it has been, this might be like a really valuable tool for them to just get like a 1 month lead on attackers, kind of in parallel, scan every system, fix the vulnerabilities, and then attackers have nothing left to find. This is the idea I'm working with. There are still questions about, do cybersecurity companies want this? And are there ways to do this that doesn't economically damage the lab? Like, one way would be to delay the public release by a month. That might be infeasible. How about if we release it early, by a month, and like forgo some safety tests for like bias, which aren't as important for cybersecurity, I'm going to go out on a limb and say, but you might still need to like do some fundamental checks on like whether the system, as I mentioned with the OpenAI evaluation, is like able to like break out and do things that you didn't intend for it to do, which could definitely happen in a cybersecurity setting. So that's concretely what I'm working on. And broadly, IAPS is a think tank which thinks about questions like this and other ones too.
Yeah, and you mentioned this paper, Societal Adaptation to Advanced AI, which you did previously when in your previous thing, which is your winter fellow at GovAI. Can you tell us a bit more about what this paper was about?
See, I wrote this with co-authors still. One was another winter fellow, Hilary Greaves, and then Abe McCoby, Leonard Heim, and Marcus Ander Young, two of those at GovAI. Abe now works at the US AICT Institute. We sort of came to this idea. It started with thinking about what AI resilience is, primarily because there was a lot of political interest in AI resilience. So I mentioned briefly what adaptation is in my conception of it, which is like, okay, we're going to have advanced AI systems around. What do we need to do? This is like both a necessary approach, as we argue in the paper, because we can't rely on like making sure that the AI systems around are particularly safe for a host of reasons, one being that that's not a very plausible outcome. But the other one is it's quite politically feasible because it means we can like develop these advanced AI systems and have them around for like all their beneficial uses, which is why we're developing in the first place. And so, yeah, so we report without like suffering any of the costs. So it's about trying to isolate like what are the harmful things and how do we like address those without hindering the beneficial use cases so much. So this was an idea that was floating around. It's something we want that I think would at that time and probably still benefits from like more precision around what sorts of interventions fall under this remit and how well do they work. So we kind of sliced off the first part of the challenge of like what sorts of interventions fall under this remit. We said there are three. One is avoidance, which can involve like setting laws. I know the UK is setting new laws now about creating non-consensual deepfakes, like sexual deepfakes of people that didn't consent to these being made. This is one way to address that risk, and maybe the best way, unfortunately, because the AI models that can do this are already out there, and there's the other approaches which I mentioned now don't work so well. So the other is defense. So assuming someone has the system, they weren't deterred from using it, and they try and use it in this way. What are things we can do to try and make it less likely that they're successful in using the system in a way that could be harmful. So classic one is cybersecurity again. If you've patched the vulnerability, they won't be able to exploit the vulnerability. I'd like to use this to also address like unintentional harms from AI systems. So there might be like defenses we could imagine in like CV screening applications where these are like quite prone to bias. There's been like a paper that showed if someone's name is in it, this does have like an influence on how the AI system will rate the CVs. So possible defense, not sure about full under defense or avoidance, is just like blinding the CVs would help, like breaking it down to smaller sections that you're trying to evaluate is something that will help. So they're kind of defensive interventions. And then the final intervention we explore is remedy. So assuming some harm has happened, how can we like recuperate some of the losses that person has experienced. And actually, topically yesterday, on the 7th of October, the UK, I think, payment service regulator invented a new remedy process, not just for AI, where if people were kind of scammed into authorizing payments from their own accounts, they could get some money back for this, which is like a new kind of remedy. But we can imagine that being really useful for AI if like people are using AI systems to persuade people to transfer money, be it like with like deep fakes of people's voices. This is like a new scam that's coming up, robocalls, which pretend to be a loved one, or just like dating app scams, which are already prevalent with like human operators. If AI systems are behind these, I wonder if that would fall under the purview of that remedial scheme. So a very topical example. So yeah, those are what we think falls under adaptation.
And what was it that made you decide to move on from Blue Dot, you know, this kind of more educational area of AI safety into, yeah, just purely research, governance research?
As I mentioned, like I initially wanted to go into nuclear fusion and be a researcher and do a PhD in physics, and then wanted to do machine learning research, and then founded this education charity. And I feel like the feeling of wanting to be a researcher never really went away through that time. Whatever researcher is, I think, you know, I've thought more about this and it's not super clear, but essentially, I think I'm just very motivated by also doing some direct work as well as the kind of like facilitation work that was involved at Blue Dot. I think I'll never like be a pure researcher going forward. I don't think that's where my skill set is or my interest. I'm like constantly pulled towards projects where it involves like facilitating people working on projects. But well, I was really for myself like unable to balance like managing these large courses and like developing my own intellect or expertise in this area. So yeah, I really want to take some time and like dig into the details again. I'm definitely getting to do that with the cybersecurity policy. It sounds really good in principle, but then you have to start writing it out and like addressing all the concerns, and it just gets very deep. And yeah, I feel really nourished by that process. So certainly like a personal will to like get into the details a bit more. And yeah, I was really happy to be at Blue Dot for 2 years, get it to a point where it's kind of running stably. The courses were iterating thanks to the whole team's efforts. People were applying to work there who were great and like much more motivated by the like inherently motivated by education itself. Whereas for me, that felt more instrumental towards like helping with develop this area, but like never saw myself as an educator initially.
So yeah, if you could do it, would that be the kind of ideal setup? If you could spend like part of your week doing research and a little bit of your week doing more kind of educational people field breed involved kind of things, would that be the best setup?
I think so. Yeah, that's really nice to me. I think these roles exist. So like, yeah, we're coming to the end of my time at IAPS, and I'm like on the lookout to see where I can apply myself in this field next. Got like a few open leads. But yeah, I think this is essentially like what a lot of people's work looks like in the policy space. So they'll spend some time like writing a paper or a particular memo, but then like have to spend a lot of time shopping that memo around as well. Like they have to go in person to deliver a talk on their work, or organize an all-day workshop with other researchers to like have them contribute and facilitate a discussion, which is very similar to what we were doing at Blue Dot, just with a different target audience. So I think these skills are definitely applicable in the policy space, and maybe my role will lean more towards engagement than like pure research than others. But yeah, trying to carve out that space, be it at an existing think tank or starting my own kind of project.
This whole kind of world you've been immersed in for like a number of years, AI safety, thinking about risks and dangers and worries, has this had any kind of impact? How does this impact you personally in your free time? Like thoughts you have, like your plans for the future, like what impact does this have just out of this purely academic, intellectual kind of exercise?
Yeah, I know some people, they can make some quite like big like decisions based on the idea that AI is going to change everything. I don't know what it says about me that it doesn't for me so much. I tend to live my life as if this wasn't happening. I guess every period of history over the last 200 years has been completely revolutionary, and it would have been foolish to like plan for life to stay the same. I really don't think life will stay the same over the next like 30 years, but I still have a pension, hope to have a family, looking for that sort of thing. I guess tend to live day by day and enjoy my life. Maybe that, you know, if I really try to philosophize about it, is like, what am I trying to do? Why did I try and work on ASAD? It's because I think like life is worth living for me and everyone. So let's try and like ensure that it's as good as possible for everyone. It's been like a driving motivation through all my areas that I've decided to work on. So I think it would be strange to like choose not to enjoy life. But that's quite extreme. But some of the actions people take seem to be not enjoying life, like working 2x as much as other people. It's not something I can sustainably do. So I just try and live like quite a normal life.
And how do you spend your free time? What do you get up to on weekends, evenings? How do you relax and unwind?
Well, as a hangover from my time in tech industry, I love bouldering. I spend a lot of time with my friends. I play the guitar from time to time. Been really going down a chess rabbit hole. All the kind of tech stereotypes there, but trying to balance out the work with normal social life.
If someone from the public who knows very little about AI, AI safety, risks, benefits, things that could go well, if they had to know one important thing that would kind of frame all of your thoughts on this area, what would it be? What should everyone know about AI and what's happening?
I think in general, I'd like encourage the people in general to like engage with AI. I think there can be a bit of a resistance to like embrace the technology, as there always is. I definitely have this like tendency to be suspicious of new fads. But I think like using ChatGPT work for certain tasks is both like pretty useful for your day to day, but also like gives you a much more I guess like inside view on what its limitations are. Like there's an area you know well, it'll sometimes say like crazy erroneous things in your field. But at the same time, there are tasks it's really good for. Like, I want to reformat this table to like have this information here instead of here. Or like use this paragraph and put it in a table. Really good for that sort of task. it is good for more intellectual tasks too. So I guess, having more of a conversation about what we want AI to be used for, how we want it to look, involves like people embracing technology and interacting with it and forming views on that. I guess that's more of a pitch than what I want people to know about it. I think another thing I want people to know about it is like not just look at it how it is today, instead try and look over the last like 3 or 4 years of like where we've come. In that time, and imagine like another 3 or 4 years of progress. You know, there are arguments about whether 3 or 4 years of progress will happen, but it's a debate. It's not like clear cut that it's going to slow down. So I think when I am talking about AI policy, I would really love it for everyone to have in mind that things could change quite dramatically, quite quickly, and usually much quicker than policy windows last for.
And just to finish now, so I'm not sure if you're aware, but I ask every guest the same question at the end of every episode. So yeah, the final question for you, Jamie, is what do you think it means to live a good life? And perhaps you can maybe tie this to some of the things you've thought and, you know, about human well-being and what's important and stuff whilst researching AI and risks and dangers and stuff.
Lovely. Very erudite. Have you listened to Peter Singer's podcast? His whole... question is asking like accomplished people, much more accomplished than me, what it means to live a good life.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I definitely recommend that if you're interested in that question. I mean, I'm somewhat stealing from what other people have said there. I wish we should look to older, wiser people on this question, but it often comes down to relationships, I think. Putting time into those, I guess, is another reason I live a normal, balanced life is I'm only happy myself if like I feel like I have stable relationships and support and like confidence that people are around to like help me, and I would help them too. It just takes time, like putting time into those relationships too. So as important as what it feels like coming out, time for that remains very important to me. And yeah, most of my states of bliss involve being around other people that I love. So I would put it down for that.
Do you think you may ever have a deep relationship with an AI system?
Oh, this is a whole other area. I'm sad we've only just raised it now. I'm working on a blog post now about AI companionship. It looks like people can form deep relationships. I, for research, opened a Replica account, which is one of these AI companion services. It's very compelling. Like, they ask you about yourself, all the things you want to say. I think I mentioned embracing technology before, but this is, I'm going to be hypocritical and be like, I just like know that it's not real. I guess things that are not real are like physical touch, facial expressions, although that might change with advanced technology. So I think people will develop deep relationships with AI. I think I'm going to try to resist the kind of non-logical reasons in this case, just to try and be around humans, because I think that's what life is about.
What are those non-logical reasons? Why would you want to resist it?
My argument breaks down. I guess actually one good reason is the AI companion services, which are around today, are products. You're the product. Again, it's trying to extract data from you. Many of the terms of services just like openly say, yeah, we're going to like sell your data. That's how we make money. Other times it's subscriptions, but they're like engineering you to have a relationship. And it's like, blog post is about sycophancy. They just agree with everything you say. This isn't like a challenging relationship. And I think it's better to be around people that you really want to be like and admire things about them and like try and learn from them. I like subscribe to the view that you're like become the average of the five people you spend the most time with, roughly. And I think it's important for society to ensure that's coming from a human place and not like big tech trying to trap you in their products. So actually, I take it back. That's a very logical reason for resisting these applications.
So you've got a blog coming out about that soon.
Hopefully with the Ada Lovelace Institute. Basically, I don't have to sign the dotted line, but we're in progress writing about that.
Yeah.
Around what society could look like if everyone had an AI companion that agreed with them all the time. The spoiler is I think like I'm trying to contrast this with the problem of echo chambers. Like, we went from a society where you had to like find people in the pub who agreed with you to like you can find any internet subcommunity which roughly agrees with something and like view splintered. If it's like one-to-one, everyone has an AI companion, what's that look like? Is it even more splintered? How far will it go? The evidence is still like early days, so trying to draw on some of the early evidence as well.
Okay, that's fascinating. Look forward to reading that. Yeah, Jamie, thank you so much for today. This has been really interesting and inspiring. Good luck with your next venture, whatever that turns out to be. And yeah, thanks again. It's been great to chat.
Thank you very much. It's been a fun conversation.
Thanks for watching this episode. If you enjoyed it, please consider hitting the subscribe button below. And I hope to see you here again.